Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things, the podcast where we talk about things for creative professionals after do weird things. I'm Adrian Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello.
Brian Brushwood.
Howdy, folks.
Gentlemen, I am on the verge of finishing a book, not a big book, you know, maybe be like 100 pages or so. And what it is, it's a collection of some of my observations about writing and some of the little short essays, some of the stuff I published, some of the stuff I haven't. And like unpublished includes a thing I wrote on how to write a novella in 24 hours, which is a thing I actually did and will be releasing soon after I edit it, because let's be honest, folks, I wrote this thing in 24 hours. And I wanted to figure out a title for it. I thought, man, I got a great title. How to write a book in 24 hours. I'm like, that's just genius. I go type it into Amazon. A lot of other people had that idea too.
I want to know how many. I'm going to Amazon.com right now. Amazon.com, how to write a book in 24 hours. And I am seeing 43 results.
Yeah, and some of those are variations on that, but essentially it's the same damn title. Now, in my defense, most of those are also kind of like they're kind of like Kindle bait kind of things, like how to write crappy sort of books you can just flip around on Kindle, you know, and like, hey, buy this book. I was more coming from the point of view as like treating like this is a, it's a marathon. It's writer's training. If you want to get really good at sitting on a keyboard and cranking things out, if you can sit down for a day and write an entire novella, you get very used to making decisions on the fly and not worrying about writer's block. And you might have something really cool, and it's a way to take advantage of limited amounts of time for it to be productive. That was my goal with it. Not like, hey, everybody, write a book a day, make 365 books a year. Like, no, like I really think you should focus on quality. But anyhow, so there I was like, man, well, what do I call it? I even made like a cool graphic with it and all that. I was testing the ebook on my different platforms and was so stoked to find out that I was totally not original. So then I'm like, what do I do? I'm like, well, I could call it like how to write a fiction book in 24 hours, because I hadn't seen that. Everybody's like, nonfiction, like, how to write a fiction book. It's kind of wordy. It looked good on the page, but it's wordy. Like, well, it's a novella. You know, novella is like an Italian word for a mini novel. So I could go with novella, and I'm realizing like, which is which? So I take screenshots of both. I send them to Justin. I send them to Brian. I send them to Bryce. I'm like a couple other people, like, hey, ask the Brain Trust. I send it to the Brain Trust of about five people. And the response was mixed.
Oh, wow. I'm curious to hear of the three of us here who heard about it, if somebody landed on a different page than I did, because I thought it was obvious. My point when I read it was, if they don't know what a novella is, then they're not your target audience. So definitely the punchier title of How to Write a Novella in 24 Hours is the way to go. But did either of you guys feel differently?
I disagreed. Yeah.
Wow.
I thought that, yeah, that novella is something that is ill-defined even amongst writers. I mean, there is a definition, but I think if you asked 10 people who considered themselves avid readers what a novella was, that you would get 10 different definitions. And I thought fiction book was just a little clearer.
I was sort of in the middle. I thought novella was a better one of the two, but I also thought
you can't even be a tiebreaker here, can you, Bryce?
I kind of thought people would think novella and think like little supermarket novels, romance novels.
So what did I decide to do? I said, you know what? I've got a few Twitter followers, some people who are always happy to sort of chime in with opinions. So I went to Google Docs, made a little form survey, and said, hey, help me answer this question. And by the way, quick question, do you know what a novella is, just so I know? And also put in your email address, and I'll send you a free copy of the book when it's ready. And if we can pop, I don't for the live listeners right now. By the way, if you want to get a free copy of the book, go sign up for my mailing list at andermain.com, and I will make sure you're included in that window. So, but anyhow, I don't know if it's convenient to pop this up for anybody who's listening right now. But if you want to answer this, I can watch your results come in live, and we're getting close to 300 replies. In the first 10 minutes, I was at like 50 responses. which is amazing. Yeah. To get that kind of data back so quickly is exciting. And it's not that this has to be the deciding factor that I'm like, oh, well, everybody says this, but it does inform you. It helps you understand how do people perceive this and am I making a good decision or not? I plan on using this going forward. I would love to, with like HarperCollins, be able to say, hey, let's use this survey kind of way as a way to get people invested in the books early on. I have a very, very active, you know, group of people here. So are you ready to hear the results so far?
Yeah.
Yeah. Can we place bets?
Well, I saw some of the initial returns. So,
okay.
So.
All right.
I will not. Brian, now that you have heard that you were outvoted 2-1 amongst the three, would you like to change your opinion on what you thought that the masses agreed?
No, now that you mentioned it, I was leaked a screenshot of the initial 50, but like, and what's funny is I just assumed that once you get to 50 responses, my guess is the 300 responses were not significantly different, but that's my only guess that I'm going to say.
Mm-hmm. Bryce, did you get shown the thing?
Yeah, I also got a screenshot.
Let's find out
how big of a margin do you think that it would have expanded to? Because the first 50 to respond are often the most engaged,
yeah,
and maybe the ones most engaged to me as a writer, where everybody else who follows after. And
I'm gonna guess the reverse. I'm gonna guess that 2-1, it was novella over fiction book, just because in the battle for titles. When people are going to pick, like pithy wins, the shorter, the tighter, the better wins, even if it's less clear what the benefit of the book is. Now, there's a difference between people saying what they want out of a title versus what they actually will respond to when it comes to buying it.
Absolutely.
So what we're getting is self-reporting of what people think a better title is, not necessarily what they would actually buy at a margin of 2-1.
And that's one of the reasons why, let's say, a company like Quirky – you know, is suffering or like is probably like, I don't know if they're bankrupt yet or not, but like Quirky, which was this consumers, people would vote on what products they thought would be the best. And they ended up manufacturing things like a special vent for your for your mirror in your bathroom. So it wouldn't get fogged up. That cost several $100.
Oh geez. Like in theory, they all think it'd be great.
That's a great idea. And if I have all this imaginary money, I'll buy. But the real thing is, we know in real markets, you need to really risk something. It can't just be votes. You have to say.
And for the record, Steve Jobs is the king of looking at consumers and be like, you're all lying. None of you actually want this. I'll tell you what you want and then you'll buy it.
No.
Yeah, and that's, October 8th, Quirky moved into bankruptcy, bankruptcy sale.
So that's the key there, is like where do people vote with their dollars? And so, you know, I look at this and I'm like, all right, I have some data here, but what's it really showing me? And
by the way, real quick, the data, I didn't realize I'd only looked at the results. I had not looked at the quiz itself, but it says, help me figure out a book title. Which is the more compelling? How to write a novella in 24 hours? How to write a fiction book in 24 hours? Want me to send you a free copy when the book is ready? Type your email address below. And then my favorite is, do you even know what a novella is? Which I can't imagine anyone would freely admit, no, they don't.
Oh, I will tell you how many people said that they didn't. Out of the 280 responses I have right now,
yeah,
a total of 23 people, approximately, roughly 10%, said no, they don't know what it is.
Wow.
Which I could have absolutely, you know, if I wanted to make that more scientific, I would have phrased it where, you know, choose, you know, what does it mean most to you? I would have phrased it differently. You know, there are things, if I was doing this as a real like scientific survey, I would have done things differently. But I did do a randomizer. So the question between novella or fiction book, it changes. So not everybody, it doesn't always appear novella first or whatever. But that being said, it's been a very good experiment. And I've got, you know, tons of people that I'm going to send free copies to. We're at 277 responses right now. And I will tell you the number of people who said fiction book.
Well, here, by the way, where can people go find this if they're listening to this podcast and they want to go find the survey?
In my Twitter feed. I mean, it's a...
There we go. bit.ly/YOLO/swag novella420.
There we go. All right. Yeah. Just go find Andrew Mann on Twitter. And what are the results?
Results are, as we speak, I have 114 people say fiction book. Subtract that from 276, which means we have 152 say novella.
Almost so one and one.
Wow.
But a real back and forth.
I mean, yeah. A 60-40 split, I'd say that's fairly significant.
Oh, I mean, sure. Yeah. I mean, it's certainly decisive, but yeah.
But it's not this, well, now the answer is clear to me, because then you start getting into, well, how do I parse this audience? You know, how do I dissect this now? Because I go, well, who voted for?
To be honest, okay, so press pause on this. You know, almost every week, John and I put out a sales email for the new item that we have at scamstuff.com. Our goal is to have a new release every single week. And as we go through it, you know, the wisdom, the conventional wisdom among direct sales folk is that you should spend as much time on your title as you should on the entire copy of everything, because the title matters very, very deeply. Unfortunately, you know, we write these big sales letters and we see that our window on Friday afternoon is closing. And so we're like, ah, crap, if we're going to do a proper A-B split campaign, for example, you know, like we have this this birthday card that plays the happy awesome birthday song nonstop until the batteries run out or until you destroy it, right? So we didn't know which is more likely to get opened, calling it best birthday card ever or worst birthday card ever. And so in a proper A-B split campaign, what you do is you send to some percentage, you know, one version to some percentage, another version, hopefully the same percentage, and you give a window of like 4 hours, but then you find yourself running out of time. It's like, well, screw it. Let's just release 50-50 across the board, and half of them will get one, half they'll get the other. And then, you know, after the fact, we'll at least know which one performed better. Even when one wildly outperforms the other, and this best birthday card, worst birthday card is a good example, because one was a clear winner over the other, but it was by a factor of, I want to say 10% maybe or something, which again, that's enough that you should do it. But as far as actual views among people who opened it, we're talking about a difference of maybe 50 emails getting opened or whatever.
Well, and that's the challenge, because it's, you know, of the people who said novella, are they the ones going to buy the book, which was your point, you know, before, or am I going to miss out on, well, everybody who would say yes to novella buy it if it was called fiction book, versus would everybody who said fiction book go, I don't know, novella is, and ignore it? And that's, you know, that gets to be sort of the challenge here. And you can, you know, probably start to ask smarter, better questions. But at the end of the day, you know, you just sort of have to go, okay, you know, novella's got a slight edge. I like novella a little bit better, so I'll just go with novella, which is what I'd probably do. And Bryce, show them the cover.
Here we go. Boom. Ladies and gentlemen, how to write a novella in 24 hours and other questionable and possibly insane advice on creativity for writers by Andrew Main. And he did not write by Andrew Main. He just wrote Andrew Main.
I was thinking about writing by and scratching it out on the cover.
You totally should.
Too inside, though. So that's the book. That'll be, it'll be like 100 pages. It won't be that much of a big of a book. And I'm going to give it free to everybody who signs up for my email list at andrewmain.com.
Now, this is an interesting question. Sunglow in the chat says, is there a reason for not using both versions? Now, theoretically, we live in an infinite universe now where you could release both versions and whichever one sold better would be that one. But what are the downsides of thinking that
way? Here's the reason why. Because especially with the kind of audience that we have, the greatest benefit is having a mass of reviews, a mass of interaction on one product. The more you can push it on that one product, the better off you are going to be. And to spread it amongst two, you know, I think that strategy is more left for like just the straight SEO, like, you know, whatever is like hot, you know, Bernie, the guide to Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, Tesla, autopilot. Like,
yeah, there comes a point where you know, you need to, you're, when you're spending more time selling the thing than trying to make the thing better, you know, and you have to divide your time, you know, appropriately. So as you talked about with the, you know, you should spend as much, just as much time using, you know, figuring out the title of the, you know, subject for the email. But it's also, I'm reminded of about 10 years ago, Apple was getting criticized and had their stock get downgraded by some analysts because they said, you know, they're not spending enough on R&D. And they go, what do you mean? Well, they go, the industry standard is to spend X amount on R&D. And Apple was having record iPod sales, huge amounts of money. And there was no sane way they could have spent that money responsibly on R&D other than hiring tons of people and creating a bunch of noise and having to say no to a bunch of crappy products. And Apple was like, no, we think we got our R&D thing, you know, we're pretty good on this. And 10 years later, they were right. And that the idea of you need to do this because this, like, well, if you have that brilliant subject line right off the bat. But I mean, you know, these are rules of thumb and understandably so. So long answer short, it's just easier to sort of settle on one. I have 277 people clicked the link and now I have a book coming out on the subject. And probably about 80 or 90% gave me their email addresses and they're going to get a free book because, you know, they'll be probably the first ones to champion and love it. And for me, it's a great pre-launch for a book that nobody's even seen yet.
I think it's a great idea and I'm really, really excited to see, well, I'm excited to read it and I'm excited to see how it does.
And you know, it's going to be coming out maybe in a week, assuming the proof comes back good. Bryce, to the image.
Yes. Of... Dun, dun.
Yeah.
Public. I decided to go with CrateSpace and do a CrateSpace version of the book and go through all the steps and all that to see how professional I can make it look. And I'm sure the proof coming back to me, I'm going to have some problems and need to adjust. But we will be having a print copy of Public Enemy Zero, clocking it at like almost, you know. And I went to try to every effort I could to make it look as professional inside as I could as far as word count, blah, 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 all that sort of stuff, you know, per page. And we'll see how well that thing works out. But that was another experiment. So,
And by the way, I mean, I don't know, maybe we talked about this when it first came out, oh, so many years ago, but that's, I was looking at that cover and I couldn't remember whether I was either in the hazmat suit or I had taken a picture of Andrew in the hazmat suit. And Andrew reminded me while I was in LA this week that it was indeed me. I'm running, booking,
dude. So you're a cover girl. You're a cover model.
Oh, yeah, look at that. I know. And they had to bag my face, you know, just, make sure it's still sellable. But
I think there's a. I'm trying to remember if there's a reflection on there, of. I'm trying to remember, like, if on this face itself, I'm trying to remember if I put like a skeleton or something in there, like a skull or.
I think so, yeah.
But yeah, that was, you see my maniacal grin reflecting in his face, actually. Like, I'm screaming.
I can't really see
it's
that.
It's hard to see. That's me there, like, just screaming at him.
Huh. Was that a natural reflection or did
you? That was exactly what was happening.
That's amazing.
Yeah, everything is just totally manufactured there. I mean, I probably took, I don't know if I took, I don't, I'm sure I didn't use an iPhone, but I took, you know, took the photo and just... Do that. I get into how to make covers, like how to make book covers in 10 minutes or less. Not that you should spend only 10 minutes on a cover, but how to have a bunch of ideas for covers.
Yeah.
And just I come up with a very simple formula to understand how to make a cover. And I break it down by taking iconic covers like Jaws and Godfather and other stuff and say, okay, here's what's going on in here. And you don't really need to have people in your covers like I do unless you're doing like sci-fi books or fantasy stuff. And just... you know, break it down so make it less intimidating. I just try to take some of these rules that took me forever to learn and then explain them to people because I just look at all the mistakes that we make that I've made.
Well, in regards to that advice, because I'm sure you factor in the fact that people are working, you know, with a budget or whatever. What is your advice to somebody who is sitting on, let's say, a perfectly well-made science fiction story or of whatever genre or whatever, because you have a natural talent for doing good Photoshop work. And I think that's part of what in the early days made your 99-cent novels really pop. In the case that maybe somebody doesn't perceive that they're as good or if they maybe unfortunately think they're as good, but maybe actually aren't or whatever, what advice would you give to folks?
So the examples I show that are super very basic. I made each one in 10 minutes just by grabbing images off of like Wikipedia or whatever. And the advice is this. I mean, first is if you have $100 to spend, you can actually buy pre-made covers, designs by people that look really good because they're artists who just sit there all day long buying royalty-free images or getting royalty-free image collections and stuff and turning them into stuff. And so for $100, you can buy a pre-made cover that looks amazing. If you want to spend $400 or $500, you can get a custom one that looks better than a lot of the stuff you see in from professional publishers. But if you don't want to spend that, what you do is the basic concept breaks down into, and I'm going to pull up my actual the thing that it breaks down to is, you know, if we take a look at, let's say, if you take a look at, let's say, the classic Jurassic Park cover, okay?
Sure. Sure.
And you have, you know, everybody knows it, but if, you know, we have an image of it, it's the Tyrannosaurus Rex skeleton.
Yeah. This is that one on the far left is the first one of the book. Yeah there you go.
That was designed by Chip Kidd,
yeah,
who is the Alex Ross of book covers. This guy's amazing. Chip Kidd's done so many iconic covers, but they didn't, you know, it's just, oh, what if we take the silhouette? So what if we have two things going on in this cover? It's a Tyrannosaurus in silhouette. And it's a scary skeleton. He's alive. He's supposed to be extinct, but this thing is clearly on the prowl, on the menace to go eat something. And so it's dinosaur looking ferocious, but we'll make it a skeleton, something that should be dead, but it ain't dead. And that was all that it took. That then became the graphic they used for the movie and continues on through this way, you know, through now to Jurassic World. So it's very basically two simple elements. If you go look at the classic Godfather, Mario Puzo cover designed by S. Neil Fujita, okay? If we take a look at that, it's a simple, one on the far left. What do we have? These old school kind of, that could be kind of Italian turn of the century letters, and a puppeteer controlling the letters. So what do we see? Somebody's pulling the strings. Somebody's in control.
Right.
All right? So simple graphic element, puppeteer, controlling the sort of ethnic or whatever sort of letters, right? Two simple elements are put together, and that's what it comes down to. If you go to Psycho by Richard Bloch, designed by Tony Palladino, it's text. It's completely textual. One on the left, that's the original one. What do we have? We have broken letters, right? Full, yeah, taking up the whole thing. So it's just the word dominating it. It's big. It's Psycho. It's broken. The two elements, broken letters. Jaws, go to the original Jaws novel by Peter Benchley. And you'll see it'll be the there you go, the one on the left, that's it. So what this is, it's not the classic movie poster with the very photorealistic looking shark. It's a much simpler shark. There are no teeth, but you see this creature shooting up from the bottom at a girl swimming, and it's all black.
Yeah.
And you get like, what do we know? It's attention. There's a girl and there's a shark coming towards this girl. So we know this is not going to be a happy meeting of the minds. The far left on the J actually looks kind of like a hook, which is another little subtle suggestion. But just basically that image of that shark and the girl, you know everything that this is going to be about. And so I go through and I create like just how would I make my own sort of dirt dumb versions of this. And, you know, I create my one, what would I do for Big Shark? And basically I just take a silhouette of shark jaws, again, in black against red and then white letters, and evoke, you know, Jurassic Park, whatever. I do Wizard Boy, which is just this wizard hat that looks like it's got the stars. You know, it's a silhouette of a wizard hat with the stars behind it. Fang Love, which is just this bleeding candy heart, you know. And then, you know, Whipping Girl, which is my 50 Shades knockoff, which is a bouquet of riding crops. And then Leonardo's Secret, which is just like an X-ray inverted image of the Mona Lisa with her eyes blacked out by, you know, letters. And these are not brilliant ones, but most of the ones, like I would arguably say, are better than most of the, you know, the indie covers that come out there, because there's a little, it's taking two elements, not more, and then reducing it to that. And
sure. You know what? Maybe now is a good time to kind of segue into picks, because let's say you have an idea of like this. Let's say you've got a very modest budget. Let's say you want to make something happen, and it's the difference between doing it and not doing it. I recommend heading over to 99designs.com. Mm-hmm. Is one of the best websites. If you have ideas and you want to leverage the wisdom of the crowds, you can get a competition started. basically you say, here's what I got. Whatever you describe the nature of the book, you describe what you want to convey. You say, I'm thinking, a bouquet made of writing crops would be an amazing way to sell this. This is the market that'll do it. And you can, you offer your own prize purse. You could say, I'll give $299 to the winning design. And of course, the more money you offer, the more people compete. But all of a sudden the next morning you wake up and there's 30 different designs, people putting together versions of it. And you're able to give hints. You're like, okay, you three are my top three. Here's what I like. Here's what I would like to see from each of you. And then finally you pick it. And then that same $300, you have elevated the entire creative process. You've gotten people to put forth their very best effort as they compete against one another, and that you are able to reap the benefit of it. I really, really like 99designs.com.
Absolutely. It's a great, great resource. And I just want to do a real quick thing to point out, too, is that there is a danger that some people will have. They'll say, oh, this is great. I can use this to design the book. And then when it comes time to promote the book, I'll go to Fiverr. And then like, oh, what's this on Fiverr? I can buy Amazon reviews.
Oh, geez. Yeah, that's probably not great.
You hear what happened?
No, what happened?
People got sued, laddie.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
Amazon is suing over 1,000 people for saying they'll post fake reviews on Amazon in support of your book.
But for the record, those are people that like accepted monetary compensation. Like, they weren't a horde of independent podcast fans who just had some charismatic host suggest that maybe they should all go to certain books and leave 5-star reviews.
That's a legitimate thing. People are really excited about those books.
There's a difference between, hey, if you like it, go tell people.
Yeah. Okay. Right on.
Hey. Somebody saying, and notice they're going after, the people selling the reviews, somebody like, hey, pay me money, I'll put a positive review there. So Amazon's trying to kill, because that's one of the things is, and I think that happens a lot. A lot of these, some of these ebook authors, you see some of these titles that like they're 48 pages and they've got like, 300 reviews. I'm like, I don't know. I'm suspicious of that. And because there is a magic formula that happens when you get up above like 70 reviews on Amazon, magic things happen. And by the way, if you haven't given good reviews to Brian's latest book or my latest book there.
For the record, let's not be shy. Go to Amazon.com. Let's say you don't want to give us any money, but give us a little bit of your time. You can give a 5-star review to Scam School Academy, which is my latest book, or what's the latest one? Name of the Devil, right?
Name of the Devil, or any other title.
The Devil. Yeah, just search Brian Brushwood or Andrew Main, and it would mean the world to us. And while you're at it, put Justin Robert Young in there, and you can leave a 5-star review for his book. Santa. A secretly gay president. I forget the rest of it. What was the rest of it?
Or it's a zombie invasion with the help of a... what was the wizard? and his smoking hot daughter whose titty falls out at one point.
Yeah, that's the... and of course, Go Home Santa, You're Drunk, which of course is about to have another round of relevance coming up on Christmas time.
It's holiday season. Go buy a bunch of dumb Santa stories.
Secretly on. Gay president thwarts zombie invasion with the help of a wizard and his barely legal smoking hot daughter whose titty falls out at one point.
It's a classic.
Don't review that. Review the books that actually matter. Don't waste your time.
So good.
I'm looking through 99designs. It is amazing the quality of stuff here that you get. And when you have like a serious book release that you want to put out there, that like what you can get, like, I have like, the designer who did my books for HarperCollins is also the guy that did Harper Lee's latest book, Go Set a Watchman. But it's awesome to work with somebody like that, but I would love to be able to like ask Harper, like, hey, can we just see what happens here if we try this? Because, I have like a big pool to choose from.
And by the way, I mean, like, it ain't, just Whistling Dixie that 99designs. Like, look at the people that have used it. There are major, major, startups and companies and people with a lot of money that, have just found really, really great work there. And really, it solves a lot of the problems with designers and graphic designers and web designers in specific that,
I mean, have you guys ever put together a project and you just, called a designer and then you, you know, talk to them about the project, and they start feeding you. And it's like whenever you try to get feedback, they just try to bully you into liking things. The reason I did that is because of and it's like, I don't want to hear it. I hate it. I hate your work.
Brian, it's why I learned effing Photoshop, okay? Like, I had a friend who was a designer, and he was just, you know, he went to school, studied for it. He was so damn sure of his own instincts and stuff. And it's like, you should be an arts major, not in marketing. And it just drove me nuts. And then I'm paying other people to do stuff where it's not like, oh, I disagree with your vision, but it was like, it was just the smugness, the attitude, dealing with a lot of those people. And I'm just like, and I can work with talented people. I work with really talented people. I work with two talented people every week, my buddies Ken Montgomery and Mary Jarris. But I mean, I absolutely love to work with people who are really talented, and I just go, just do it and come back. And they're always going to amaze me and be brilliant at what they do. And it's far better than anything I can do. And then there are other people who have some talent, but have a lot of ego, which might describe me, honestly. But it just is annoying. I learned how to edit video and learn how to shoot photo. You know, like, now I can go to people who are like great at that stuff and do it way better than I. But when it comes to graphic design,
it's very, very frustrating. And it's only because I have a few really, really good friends that are designers that I know enough about design that I can at least like have a general sense of what I want and what I don't want, and know when to walk away from a conversation. And if it weren't for the fact that I felt comfortable talking to like Megan Fawn, who designed everything for The Contender, it would have been infuriating to put that much, you know, considering how much we've invested in that now, in the hands of people that like, you know, have, you know, the first impression of your product in their hands. And if you don't agree with where it's going and they're trying to push an agenda on things, then like that you don't agree with, it's insanely frustrating. And I love that 99 Designs, you know, basically inverts that power structure and says, hey, look, you are artisans and you are artisans who deserve to be paid. However, you're going to have to compete, and you're going to have to bend
it's your own
wheel.
Personal Hunger Games. May the odds be forever in your favor. Also, have it by Tuesday. This is going out to be published soon.
And man, do professional designers hate that, you know, and you get these, the cult of the amateur and the people that are driving the price down. Well, yeah, you know. That might mean that there's a, because I've had friends that were like, you know, I've had friends who were like web designers and stuff like that. They had clients they could make things easier for, and no former friends, by the way, they would not do it because they knew they wouldn't be able to charge as much per month. You know, they wouldn't move into like a WordPress thing or whatever because they wanted that paycheck to do that, or they wanted it, you know, they wanted X number of revisions or whatever like that. And man, you know, any system that's like that's ripe for disruption. We're seeing that now.
Well, and it's not that all designers are like this. It's enough of them are like it for it to be a problem.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. When it comes to picks, the pick that I'm going to pick for my pick is going to be the pick that I'm going to say right now. What I'm going to say, go to andrewmeade.com, sign up for my mailing list if you want a free copy of the book. But I just finished watching... I found it on YouTube. It was a BBC production, and it ended up there. And can't find anywhere else, but it's on the YouTube. And, you know, if Socialist paid for, I'll watch it. The BBC production of the original Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which was, you know, the radio play came before that, whatever. I loved Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy as the book. I never listened to the radio drama, but I remember watching the old TV show. So much more fun than the movie they tried to make. And all the episodes are up there. See how long that stays there, whatever. But I thoroughly, thoroughly, thoroughly thought it was fun. And I went to watch it again. And just what a genius Douglas Adams was. What a loss it was when he left this planet. But I highly recommend it, if you haven't seen this in forever, is to go check out The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's an episodic form. All the episodes are up there.
Hitchhiker's Guide was one of the most memorable book reading experiences I've ever had. I was reviewing the movie And I decided I'd never read it. And I decided I was going to like, well, I'll read as much as I can before I got to go leave. Because I think the review, the theater that I had to review, it was in Albany and I was in Syracuse. So it's like an hour drive. And so I just went to go get my morning coffee. I had the full day of classes and I had like an hour until my class. So I got a coffee and I sat down and I started reading the book and I skipped all of my classes right up until I needed to leave to go watch the movie. Because I was so engrossed in every little nook and cranny of that story. Douglas Adams, just, I mean, when you talk about funny writing is so hard. Because, like, it's hard enough to make somebody laugh right in front of you. To tell a joke so funny or to turn a phrase so clever that it just rests in amber forever, and anybody who picks it up can get what you were saying and find it funny for the reasons you were trying to evoke, is just insane. Like, and there's a reason why we don't see a lot of, you know, the top books on the bestseller list. The funny ones are usually very contemporary ones. They're about very contemporary things, or they're written as essays by very funny people that we find funny currently. Rare is the book or rare is the author who is able to be so clever and so funny and have it read as fresh. I mean, when I read it, you know, decades after it had come out and become an institution. But just brilliant. Anybody who hasn't read it, just do yourself a favor.
It's funny because I find myself so partial to the journey. I mean, what an unusual story in that it began as a radio drama. The first time I ever read it was reading the script for the radio drama, which I believe was published after it was published as a book, as a series of novels, you know, and then separate from that, the television show and various movies and so on. It's amazing that so many people experienced it so many different ways and that each one feels like, you know, there's a more right way, I guess. I don't know.
Except for the movie.
I didn't mind the movie. I don't harbor the same strange dislike for the movie that a lot of people have.
I don't hate it. It's just not as joyful as the other productions.
Yeah. And yet it also didn't have the finality element of it, like that there is, you know, this, it has to start, you know, from kind of pure black to, and then it becomes this joyful kind of story. And yet it was never for me as black as it needed to be, nor as fun as it needed to be. And it just kind of rested in this mushy middle while still doing justice to, I think, some of the, you know, the core characters and concepts. Like, you know, the cast there, I think, is, you know, still very, very interesting for those roles. But ultimately, I think it did just kind of, you know, it just missed the mark.
Guys, I just saw this on my Twitter feed. There is a Humble Bundle right now. Humble Bundle, Goosebumps. Pay what you want for a collection of Goosebumps audiobooks. We've got 4, 9, 12, 15 audiobooks could be yours for $15.
Who's reading them?
Nice.
These books. Nice.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm buying this right now. Sorry. Didn't mean to distract you right there, but you know, time's running out. Only 2 hours left.
Oh, hell yeah. All right. My pick for this episode is Daredevil. So I stopped watching Daredevil, not because I didn't like it or love it. I did. I just wound up getting busy and I stopped watching it. I started watching it again because I've been sick for most of this week and I've done mostly nothing but sleep and watch Daredevil and work. Man, is it so good. Oh, my God. I'm just in love with it, and I'm just in love with where the world it created, and, like, you know, it's one of those things that you watch so much television that deals with subject matter that you love and want to defend. And you're always just like, you know, I mean, like, it's good. And then you get in your fights with your friends and they're like, oh, my God, wasn't it great on Heroes when they did that thing? And you're like, I mean, yeah, but it was just kind of stupid. And I don't know why they're doing this. And it's like, wasn't it great on Doctor Who when the doctor said, bleh? And you're like, yeah, but why did he have to go and do that? It's just like a weird thing. And then you watch Daredevil and it's just like, yes. Oh, my God, all these themes. Look. A comic book story can have rich and compelling themes, and every character, every episode revolves around everyone's balance, that everyone is a certain level of light and dark, and it is the conflict between them that is moving all these things forward, and they are all careening against each other to create a big, gigantic conclusion. And when you think, now that I've gotten further into it and you see kind of the themes that they are painting with Matt Murdock, you're like, oh, my God, they are just explicitly setting up the Punisher to be his – the Punisher is his dark doppelganger, not Wilson Fisk. You know,
right.
We have Fisk is his foil, you know, but like the Matt Murdock character, which is, I will do – everything I can, I will be relentless in my pursuit, but you know, to kill is to go too far, because that gives in too much to my darkness, matches perfectly with the yin and the yang of, yeah, check on all that, except I definitely kill people all the time, of the Punisher, you know, because they deserve it and the world's better off with these people dead. You know, it's just so good. And I was so excited to see the trailer for season two and to see the big money quote on the recap that they showed at New York Comic Con, that also showed the images for the new season, was "Get aboard the hype train," which was written by Victoria McNally, aka at VQ Nerdballs on Twitter, a longtime fan of NSFW show and Night Attack.
Oh, that's amazing. I did not know that. That's huge.
I was so excited to see her excited about that. So yeah, I'm super pumped by Netflix. Netflix is in, you know, it's funny because they shed a bunch of, or sorry, they missed their expectations for subscribers this quarter. But I just kind of wonder, you know, how much that has to do with, like, they got to keep pumping out a steady stream of awesome, engrossing original content so people keep watching it. And it feels so rad as a consumer to have that machine with that kind of money have their profit motivation be, no, we got to put out not just stuff, but good stuff.
Yeah, dude, for the record, like recently Netflix announced that they were going to raise the price to, I think, $9.99 from $7.99 or $8.99. Still worth it. You could raise it to $20 and I'll give up my Netflix over my cold, dead Flint fingers, man. It's like just the content, the originals alone merit it. It's so good.
It's such a great approach they took. And you know, years ago when they first launched their streaming service, their pundits were like, well, are you going to be selling videos too? And like, no, we are not going to sell videos.
Speaking of which, bit of a controversy, are you guys going to watch Beasts of No Nation? Because apparently they've got a lot of upset movie theaters at them.
Well, the story says there are a lot of upset movie theaters, but nobody cared. It was a non-controversy where they decided to do a limited release, put this into theaters, you know, so they could qualify for Academy Awards. And journalists like, upset movie theater. They didn't care, you know. It was the Netflix hype machine.
Yes. If you put Netflix in a headline, people will click on the headline because people are interested in Netflix. Like, yeah, that is a dumb controversy. They literally just want Idris Elba nominated for an Oscar and they're going to put a tremendous money and PR machine behind him to do it. So, you know, that's what that is all about. And also it's like, yeah, you know, that's they want people to watch it on Netflix. Like, that's what they want.
There is no theater owner was going, ugh, you know what we needed this week in The Martian? No, not The Martian. Goosebumps? No, not Goosebumps. Crimson? No. Beast of No Nation. That's what was going to be the. Again, I'm sure it's a fantastic film, but they weren't like going, oh my God, if only we could have had this, you know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, like Steve Jobs, which might have the biggest name recognition or crossover potential of a indie film, you know, quote unquote, is very slowly scaling up its theater count. I don't think that the economics of a gritty African child soldier drama is going to get people flocking to the theaters. Like, you know, it's whatever.
By the way, on the subject of Steve Jobs, I hear it's a great movie, but apparently technically Goosebumps is the more accurate biography.
I need to see Steve Jobs because I really want to say it, even though I haven't seen it. And this is – just know that when I say this on Twitter, it's going to be a preconceived notion that I'm going into watching Steve Jobs with. But I believe Steve Jobs will be the greatest and most accurate Aaron Sorkin biography ever produced. I feel like there's just Aaron Sorkin so well known for imbuing so much of himself in these great
– Aaron Sorkin, yes.
With great flawed man stories that I just kind of feel that this is just Aaron Sorkin working out a lot of his own pathos about like, well, you can't get over these certain things. It's like, so what are the relationships that you have with the people in your life, Aaron?
I've had two people who've seen it and then give me reports on it who knew nothing about it. Like, wow, one guy compared him, walked away comparing him to Pablo Escobar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, in a Facebook thing, and I go, well, that's kind of harsh. And this person got upset that I said that. And I said, I'm not criticizing review, but I'm like, that is a harsh comparison for you to walk away from. And I had another friend that's like, oh no, you'd really like it. And I go, oh, does it have this kind of, you know, does it talk about like when he later became a great family man and all that? No. I'm like, well, you know, maybe it's not the whole journey. You know, maybe, I don't know.
I mean, the argument, you know, that has been made is that it's not supposed to be accurate. It is a fictionalization of somebody that has a tremendous stature and casts a tremendous shadow on our modern landscape. I am fine with that description of it, but I don't blame people that were close to him or people that have followed his work for being upset with the movie. Like, I just think this is such a weird argument that, like, you know, people who are like, oh, it's fiction, why are you getting upset? It's like, okay, yeah, no, that's fine.
Well, two things. One is, I'm not seeing it. I'm speaking in ignorance. The impression I get is a very good depiction of young Steve Jobs, of what was this guy like at 23. And then they carry him over through the rest of it, which is not what the people around him said. No, he was a different guy. And this is, you know, the Isaacson biography, these other stuff, they just sort of capture on, well, look at this guy. And they're used to people being the same throughout. That said, but the argument, like, well, it's fiction. Well, then don't call it Steve Jobs. You're calling it Steve Jobs because nobody will see it if you make up a different name. You know, that's where it gets into this, you know. But again, I encourage everybody to get their own opinion about it instead of listening to me because I drank the Kool-Aid.
It is one of those things that
Steve Jobs, such a jerk stories.
The ongoing thread of the movie and really what has gotten people upset is that Aaron Sorkin admittedly could not get past the fact that Steve Jobs had this very fractured relationship with his, you know, the mother of his daughter and his daughter through, you know, the first years of her life. He, upon seeing the movie, or maybe reading the script, I can't remember which, the real Lisa Jobs told Aaron Sorkin, could you please just make it a little nicer? Because it was not this terrible for me growing up.
Wow.
So it's, you know, again, I feel this. My pre-prejudice going in is that it will be the greatest Aaron Sorkin biopic about Aaron Sorkin that Aaron Sorkin has ever created.
Yeah. Gentlemen, I've degraded my signal considerably because just download all of my Bumps audiobooks.
Oh, God. All right.
That's all right.
It's been after.
It's all right. It's been after.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.